Case for argument this morning is K against Chicago Board of Education. Mr. Plotkin.
May it please the court. I wanted to address a couple of preliminary points that came out of defendants, the Board of Education's response brief. One of them is that the Board indicates that...
Is one of the points you're about to address subject matter jurisdiction?
I will eventually address that, but...
I think that's first.
We had asserted two claims involving breach of the settlement agreement and the Section 1983 claim.
Yes, those are the two federal claims. Have you ever asserted a claim under the Fair Labor Standards Act?
We have not.
All right. The problem I see with subject matter jurisdiction is related to some cases that the parties do not cite. The Supreme Court held in a case called Kokkonen against Guardian Life Insurance back in 1994 that breach of a settlement reached in a federal case is not a federal claim, and it must be litigated under the diversity jurisdiction. The only way to get it into federal court is under the diversity jurisdiction. And so I don't understand how, consistent with Kokkonen, this case can be in federal court if it doesn't have an FLSA claim. The whole premise of this litigation seems to be that breach of a settlement agreement negotiated to end federal litigation is a federal claim, and the Supreme Court has held otherwise.
My understanding was that the 1983 claim provided a basis for federal jurisdiction.
That's exactly what the Supreme Court in Kokkonen rejected. Moreover, in a case called McGuire against Springfield back in 2002, when parties tried to evade Kokkonen by saying failure to honor the settlement agreement is retaliation, we rejected that claim. We said it's incompatible with Kokkonen. So this case, although the parties seem to be unaware of Kokkonen, contains not only the Kokkonen problem, it contains the attempted evasion of Kokkonen that 6 years ago we rejected.
Subject matter jurisdiction is waivable by the defendant.
It is not. Subject matter jurisdiction can never be waived. It's something the court must take notice of on its own, whether or not the parties have raised it, and even if the parties try to stipulate it. That's just about the most basic principle of federal jurisdiction.
Your Honor, peculiarities of the way that this case appears before you is that defendant, after we filed our complaint, defendant filed a 12B6 motion to dismiss. In none of those none of those arguments that were made by the defendant were ruled on by the district court. Instead, one of the alternative bases that the Board of Education raises here today is...
Does any of this bear on subject matter jurisdiction?
Yes. And that is, we wanted, in the event that the court decides to affirm the district court's decision or on the basis of its sua sponte dismissal of the case on the basis of improper venue, we wanted an opportunity to amend the complaint. We've never had that opportunity to do so. We can address this particular problem in the course of amending the complaint.
And how would you do that?
By asserting an FLSA claim. to the extent that we're able to. I mean, obviously, I'm unaware of it and need to research it, but if there's some possibility that we can go ahead and assert that claim, we shouldn't be denied that opportunity at this time.
Tell you what, I would like both sides to file supplemental memoranda addressing subject matter jurisdiction within 10 days. And these memoranda should address the bearing of Kokkonen, the bearing of McGuire against the city of Springfield from 2002, and the question whether a non-frivolous amendment to the complaint could add a Fair Labor Standards Act claim. Maybe I should say could add a timely Fair Labor Standards Act claim.
Does the court wish to hear any further argument at this point?
Your only chance.
Thank you. The defendant's board indicates that the basis for review by this court is clear error. That is wrong. This court exercises de novo review on the dismissal of the complaint pursuant to Federal Rule 12b-3. Secondly, the board also states that Judge Norgel did not dismiss the complaint sua sponte for improper venue. You can't read Judge Norgel's decision in both its introductory paragraph as well as its conclusion without seeing that the words that he uses is that he is dismissing the case sua sponte for improper venue. 1 year ago, today, this court issued its decision in Auto Mechanics versus Vanguard Car Rentals, in which the court overruled and reversed Judge Norgel's decision to reverse Judge Norgel's decision to dismiss that complaint for improper venue sua sponte. And several months later, in CPL versus Fradchem, this court affirmed its prior decision and again reversed Judge Norgel who had dismissed the complaint for improper venue and had instead said that the case called for arbitration. those same principles underlying those decisions are applicable here, and the court should reverse Judge Norgel's decision and dismiss this case sua sponte as well. We had argued that, moreover, that breach of the settlement agreement claim, as well as the 1983 claim, were in any event not subject to arbitration. The settlement agreement was entered into at the time that it was entered into. Ms. Kay was not an employee of the Board of Education. She was not a member of the Chicago Teachers Union. The teachers' union was not a party to the Guajardo lawsuit. There was no provision in the settlement agreement that provided that any disputes arising under the settlement agreement would be subject to the arbitration provision of the collective bargaining agreement. In fact, there's no provision in the settlement agreement from the first lawsuit Ms. Kay filed, which would have established that any disputes arising under the settlement agreement would be arbitrated anywhere. the claims that the board has also asked that this court undertake for the first time to rule on the merits of its motion to dismiss under 12b-6. The board took no appeal from Judge Norgel's decision, which denied that motion as moot. We believe that the claims that are asserted satisfy the Bell Atlantic standard. We pleaded them in sufficient detail to provide the defendant with fair notice of what the claim was, as well as the grounds upon which it was based, and our right to relief is plausible and rises above the speculative level. For those reasons, we believe that all the claims in the complaint are properly stated. And again, you know, in the event that the court decides to take the board up on the 12B6 motion and dismiss the complaint, we'd like an opportunity to amend the complaint. There's no there's been no decision reached on the merits of the complaint at this point, number one. Number two, there's nothing under Federal Rule 15 that would have foreclosed us from having the opportunity to go ahead and file the complaint, amend the complaint.
Could you tell me what your 1983 claim is? I understand it's retaliation. Retaliation for what?
In the aftermath of the settlement of the first 1983 settlement federal lawsuit, the board has punished Ms. Kay by bringing her back and not paying her.
Punished her for reaching that settlement?
That's correct, for asserting her rights as she did in the former lawsuit.
It's not because of her activities on that board or LSC, whatever it was.
Well, that was the basis for the original lawsuit, and you know, it's because of what she did that gave rise to her participation in that case in the 1983 claim. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Plotkin. Mr. Trent.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mark Trent. I represent the defendant Appley Board of Education of the City of Chicago. Your Honors, no matter what costume one puts on this claim, it's simply a claim for wages unpaid by someone who alleges...
Begin with subject matter jurisdiction.
Your Honor, the subject matter jurisdiction was an issue that was presented in the motion to dismiss the case.
I don't understand it. 12b-6 has to do with stating a claim on which relief can be based. Jurisdictional motions are raised under 12b-1. Are you saying there's a 12b-1 motion that the district judge didn't reach?
No, Your Honor. We just raised the issue in the motion to dismiss that there was no statement in the complaint that the federal court had retained jurisdiction to enforce the settlement agreement. That, as you note, was probably more properly raised under the other section. We did include it, nevertheless, in the motion that we filed before the court.
So there's yet another problem in this case, that a jurisdictional argument was made to the district court and ignored by the district judge?
Your Honor, it was unclear from the complaint. It's my understanding of the law is that it is proper for a district court can retain jurisdiction to enforce an agreement brought before it. At that stage of the proceedings, we were not in a position to raise that issue and say one way or another whether or not the court had, in fact, determined whether they would.
Now I'm completely lost. If you want to know whether the district judge in the first case retained jurisdiction to enforce the settlement, all you have to do is look at the judgment. And that's a public record. So I assume you've looked at the judgment.
Yes, we did, Your Honor. But
what does it say?
There is nothing either in the complaint or in the judgment about the court retaining jurisdiction.
All that matters is the judgment. That's what I thought. The first judgment did not purport to retain jurisdiction.
That's correct.
Right. That's the source of the Kokkonen problem.
Yes.
Given Kokkonen, it is not a violation of federal law to fail to keep promises made in a settlement agreement.
That's correct, and we did argue in the motion.
That's the Kokkonen problem. Right. So what you're saying is you argued to the district court that there was no subject matter jurisdiction, and the district court ignored this argument.
We did not put it in those terms. We argued in the motion to dismiss that the case, that the alleged breach of the settlement agreement should be more properly brought in state court. Now, we did not use the term subject matter.
You thought there was no subject matter jurisdiction in this case. Why didn't you put this in your brief on appeal?
Your Honor, the
jurisdictional statement in your brief says the jurisdictional statement in appellant's brief is complete and correct, and you're now telling us that you knew it was not complete and correct.
Your Honor, the problem is the existence of the Section 1983 claim. And that was basically the thinking behind the motion to dismiss, which was originally filed. As long as the 1983 claim is out there, I believe that has to be attacked before there could be a finding that the federal court doesn't have jurisdiction. Your Honors, I believe that the district court saw this simply as a claim for wages unpaid, and they saw it as such and made a ruling accordingly.
What is the school board's position, by the way? Is it that the wages have actually been paid and this whole suit is a sham?
The board's position is that the appellant was never an employee of the board. We believe, although this is hypothetical at this point, we believe that they're in fact, it was a sham. The appellant was never retained by the board with the position.
Never worked as a teacher in the schools for these 7 years?
Your Honor, that is a factual issue we haven't come to yet. Our understanding or our belief at this point is that the appellant may have worked in the school but worked without authorization. She showed up. Apparently conducted some classes with the apparent approval of the principal of the school. However, she was never hired as an employee. And
And the schools were just assigning pupils to a stranger's room, and the school allows people to wander in off the street and assign students to their room. If this is actually how the Chicago schools are conducted, I suppose it's easy to see why people don't learn anything there.
No, Your Honor, I believe, and again, this is hypothetically what happened.
This is not anything hypothetical, counsel.
Yeah.
These are real parties. This is real litigation, and we need to know what really happened. This is not a hypothetical question about what happened on Mars.
Then I will address that. The settlement agreement provided that the appellant, in order to continue her employment at the Chicago Public Schools, would have to obtain a position by a certain date. Appellant did not obtain such a position by a certain date. The appellant nevertheless reported to the school and apparently with the acquiescence of the principal took some part in the administration of classes there, basically became a teacher.
In other words, she taught at the schools for 7 years.
She was in the classroom and apparently conducting some teaching duties without authorization from the board and with the knowledge and acquiescence of the principal. And the rationale behind that is very simple. We believe that the evidence would show that the principal thereby would obtain an extra teacher without that counting towards her budget. Therefore, she had some incentive to continue this ongoing for 7 years. And given that the appellant was never assigned a position number, there's no way that the board's human resources would know that she was there teaching without authorization. And it is...
I think, although perhaps this is a question under state law, that a school's principal has apparent authority to hire teachers.
They do have the authority to hire teachers, but not if they don't have a position open. And we believe that's what happened here.
Your position seems to be that if a teacher wrongfully hires someone, there's no open position at the school.
Right.
The principal says to someone, you're hired as a teacher, come to work. And the principal is lying, that the school board doesn't have to pay.
That would,
the teacher rather than the principal bears the loss.
Yes, that would be correct. If someone is in a school teaching without authorization, then they are not entitled to be paid.
As I've described it, as you've described it, the teacher had actual authorization. The principal actually hired this person, and you agree the principal has authority to do that, but you say the principal did it improperly.
The principal has authority to hire teachers, but not to hire teachers for which there is no position open.
So your argument, as I understand it, is if a principal actually hires a teacher, but the principal erred in some way, the loss falls on the teacher.
Well, it's not a question of the principal erring. There's a process that a teacher has to go through in order to be hired by the Chicago Public Schools. This principal did not use that provision. A teacher, in order to teach at the Chicago Public Schools, must be assigned a position number. And if there's no position number available, a principal has no authority whatsoever to hire such a person. Therefore, in this situation, the principal did not have authority. The appellant was never given permission or authorized to teach in that school, and therefore she is not entitled to be paid as a teacher. She was never an employee. Your Honor, just to address the waiver issue, prior to the filing of the answer in this case and before ruling on defendant's pending motion to dismiss, the court, district court in this case, asked both parties to address the issue of whether the binding arbitration provisions of an existing collective bargaining agreement governed plaintiff's claim for wages. Both parties briefed the issue, and the board took the position that the arbitration provisions were applicable. This position is not inconsistent with the position in the pending motion to dismiss, or the motion which was pending at the time, that the pendant state law claims were barred because the arbitration provisions were controlling. The district court considered the arguments included and concluded that plaintiff's claim for wages did not belong in the federal courts. Had the board taken a position similar to plaintiff that the wage claim was not arbitrable, or alternatively, had the district court not allowed the parties to address the issue and somehow misconstrued the application of the arbitration provision, then the ruling could be problematic. However, neither was the case here. That distinguishes this case from those cited by the appellant. Provision 12H1B2 of the amended rules of civil procedure allows inclusion of defenses up to the point of filing of an amended answer or responsive pleading pursuant to Rule 15A1. With respect to the, and I would first like to address the Section 1983 claim, because it is our position that that was added just to for purposes of getting by the jurisdictional argument. And counsel indicated.
Well, it doesn't. That's one of the holdings of McGuire against Springfield.
Your Honor, we believe.
You'll be addressing McGuire against Springfield, I trust.
That's correct, Your Honor. In any event, the counsel indicated that there's no action cited in the complaint or referred to in the complaint that occurred after the execution of the settlement agreement. The counsel, the brief for the appellant, cites to First Amendment issues, and it basically relates back to the actions that happened prior to that settlement agreement. Therefore, by including the Section 1983 claim in this case, the appellant is just trying to get the jurisdiction of the federal court by going back to activities which occurred prior to the time of the previous settlement agreement and are barred by that settlement agreement. The equitable claims of the appellant are barred by the same mandatory arbitration provisions which are the basis of the district court's ruling. The existence of an enforceable written contract bars...
I'm lost. Either there's no plausible 1983 claim, in which event this doesn't belong in federal court, and the order for arbitration was unauthorized because the district judge doesn't have subject matter jurisdiction, or there is a real 1983 claim. And if there's a real 1983 claim, I don't see how it can be arbitrated, consistent with cases like Alexander against Gardner Denver.
We are not taking the position that the 1983 claim can be arbitrated. We're taking the position that the 1983 claim does not exist. It was not stated in the complaint. In fact, there were affirmative allegations in the complaint which would bar the 1983 claim from being pursued. There's no policy alleged. There are no actions by policymakers of the board alleged. And therefore, the 1983 claim...
I'm now totally flummoxed. You, in the prior exchange with me, you said the reason for the nonpayment was policies of the board. The teachers could not be paid unless the principal could assign a particular slot number. Well, that is a policy of the board. Now, it may be a good policy, but it's certainly a policy of the board.
Well, I believe that the complaint is alleging that somehow there's a policy of the board not to pay its employees. I don't think they're referencing that policy that the court just cited. I don't see how such a claim could form the basis for a Section 1983 claim if someone is taking that it's a policy of the board to allow unauthorized acts. Or that's unauthorized. The fact that an act is not authorized by the board would lead to a policy claim. Appellant affirmatively alleges that she worked as a teacher in the Chicago public schools system. As such, she was a member of the teacher's bargaining unit, even if she was not a member of the union. Pursuant to Section 5.3 of the Illinois Educational Labor Relations Act, appellant is bound by the mandatory arbitration provisions of the collective bargaining agreement. Appellant has pled herself out of court on her remaining claims. Her complaint admits that she did not find a position within the time frame contained in the settlement agreement. She cannot, therefore, claim a position based on that agreement. In conclusion, this claim for wages by whatever name is not an appropriate matter for the federal courts to determine. I would therefore respectfully...
And why not? There is, of course, a federal statute on payment of wages. It's the Fair Labor Standards Act.
That claim was not alleged in the complaint. And
one might be coming.
Well, the district court has to obviously act on what's before it, and that was not before it. Because the breach of the settlement agreement belonged in state court, and because there's nothing alleged in the complaint which would give rise to a 1983 action, the complaint should have been dismissed and was properly dismissed by the district court, and I would therefore respectfully ask that the decision of the district court be affirmed.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Trent. Anything further, Mr. Plotkin?
The situation with respect to Ms. Kay is even more shameful for the board than this previous exchange with counsel indicated. Within two pay periods, first of all, at the time in August of 1997, Ms. Kay was teaching at the Solomon Schechter School in Skokie. She received a telephone call from the principal at Disney Magnet School, where she had taught for 20 years before she was forced out and left in 1994, inviting her to come back to the school. She did that and understood that the general counsel from the law department, pursuant to the settlement agreement, had asked that, had informed the principal that he could go ahead and bring Ms. Kay back. Ms. Kay was highly regarded. At some point during the subsequent 7 years, she was under some preliminary consideration for one of the Golden Apple Awards. She never entered that situation at Chicago Public Schools with the idea that she was volunteering her time. She expected to be paid. In fact, after she wasn't paid the first couple of pay periods...
The puzzlement for me from the beginning of this case is that somebody who works and isn't paid has a remedy, and it's usually a remedy that provides for double or treble damages. Every state has a wage payment statute. Illinois is one of them. If the employer doesn't pay wages to somebody, and usually these statutes cover people who work or are suffered to work, and the board's view is that she was suffered to work even if she hadn't been properly hired, Usually these things provide for speedy remedies in state court and damages multipliers. But why are we here rather than there?
Judge, I came across this matter 1 month before the complaint was filed, after 2 years after everything had happened. I don't know why it wasn't pressed. What happened was that Ms. Kay went to the law department.
What is the statute of limitations on the Illinois wage payment statute?
I think it's 3 years. I'm not positive of that. I think
we're longer than the 1983 statute of limitations.
Yes. Ms. Kay went to the within a pay period and two pay periods, and repeatedly throughout this period of time, Ms. Kay went to the law department, spoke with attorneys from the law department, who told her they were aware of her situation, they were in the process of figuring it out, and it was delay, and nothing happened, and no one ever told her that the problem was that she was part of this extraneous agreement between the principal and herself that just didn't exist. The board was aware of it through her own lawyers. Thank you, Judge.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Plotkin. The case is taken under advisement.